The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojin Kimmel at Zen Mountain Monastery. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
We invoke your name, Manjushri. We aspire to learn your way, which is to be still and to look deeply into the heart of things and into the hearts of people. We will look with all our attention and open-heartedness. We will look with unprejudiced eyes. We will look without judging or reacting. We will look deeply so that we will be able to see and understand the roots of suffering, the impermanent and selfless nature of all that is. We will practice your way using the sword of understanding to cut through the bonds of suffering, thus freeing ourselves and other species. That's a teaching by Thich Nhat Hanh on invocation of Manjushri, the bodhisattva of discriminating wisdom, prajna wisdom, the bodhisattva that we're looking at in art practice this month. And to review, a bodhisattva is you, one who is practicing to relieve your suffering and the suffering of others, before just, you know, saying, I'm out of here. We wait for everyone to come along, everyone. That's a bodhisattva. So I'd like to kind of speak about what I'm learning about the spiritual energy of Manjushri, being in touch with this bodhisattva, who's one of the most prominent bodhisattvas in the Mahayana. In the Mahayana Sutras, often associated close to Shakyamuni Buddha, usually shows up when Shakyamuni is there, and especially associated with the teachings of the Prajnaparamita. Form is exactly emptiness, emptiness exactly form. And in many monasteries, it's Manjushri who's in the Zendo. Ha! The samurai. Cut it off. Stop it. Stop it. So that's what Manjushri is, a powerful, striking figure. Was often seen as a he, but then became more androgynous as time went on. And here's this, I'm sure you've seen it, this pose that's relaxed, sitting cross-legged, a sword in the right hand, and in the left, like, open, like, there's often a little curve in the body, too. And in the left hand is sometimes the Prajnaparamita text, or that Prajnaparamita text could be on the top of the head. Sometimes Manjushri is holding a scepter or a lotus, which has a long vine connected to the muck, right? Because that's how it blooms. You know, it has to have all the mulch of our suffering, of our darkness, in order for it to have that bloom. So those are the depictions. And often there's a youthful presence, which I'll speak about. Usually Manjushri is about 16, right? That kind of fresh youthfulness. And the color is usually a reddish, a yellow with a reddish tint, like the sun. It's said that this color of Manjushri is to wake us up like the sun does. That's why it's this golden color with this reddish outline, the sun that wakes us up. And the sword is sometimes has flames coming off it, and it's double-edged, as we know in our life. It's double-edged. And often we see Manjushri, like in the Buddha Hall, riding a lion or sitting on a lotus pad, right? But the lion is more of a stately lion. It's not ferocious. It's not ready to attack. It's our nobility. It's the king of the beasts, the queen of the beasts, this lion posture, right? And any words that were spoken, by the Buddha were said to be the lion's roar, this fearlessness and confidence needed to present the profound teachings of the Dharma. So we see that in our Shuso Hosen ceremony, right? The person finishes their talk, and then they do that walk to the teacher, right? And the person's chanting the poem from their verse, and then they finish the inexhaustible lion's roar, and the teacher says, holding up the sword, how will you use this shepe? And the student says, freely, giving life and taking it away. Because Dharma encounter is about to begin, right? How will you use this sword? Freely, giving life, taking it away. So that's the sword we have in our hands as Manjushri, that kind of energy, giving life, taking it away freely. And then it's passed on. Sometimes, so this lion is calm, fearless, courageous, noble type of way. And sometimes Manjushri is shown with a long flowing mane of hair. Sometimes it's put into 5 top knots, which is the symbol for Mount Wutai, which is 5 peaks. So that's Manjushri's mountain. People often go there on pilgrimages to get Manjushri energy. They go to Mount Wutai, which we know from some of the koans. So Manjushri being associated with the Prajna Paramita, Jizo was more, of course, that effort, Paramita, that joyful effort. And even though all the Paramitas run through the Bodhisattvas, this we would say Manjushri is more Prajna Paramita, the wisdom aspect of our nature. And the word Prajna, that comes, means, pra is means before, and jna is wisdom. So it's the wisdom before we know, that kind of wisdom. So it's not intellectual wisdom, it's the wisdom that we always have. The wisdom before we know becomes before any knowing, before any conceptualization. Before we know it's raining, or we call it rain. It's just that experience of that. One teacher noted, if we call it the wisdom of unknowing, the wisdom of the source, the wisdom of non-duality, then you have a piece of candy in a beautiful wrapper. It's no longer prajna. It's another idea. So to keep that before knowing quality in our mind, the freshness and aliveness, that's that youthful aspect. So it's the perfection of discrimination. So that is us when we are the one who cuts through ignorance and delusion and we penetrate to what's real and true. That's Manjushri energy. I spoke of emptiness in the last talk, so just to review, using Thich Nhat Hanh, where he says, recalling the feeling of emptiness, shunyata, it sounds like a vacancy, a loss, an empty something. But he says it's not emptiness, it's fullness. I think it's interdependence, or that quality where there's nothing separate. Empty means empty of a separate self, empty of any distinct permanent qualities, in a constant state of flow, moving, change, right? We can't grasp it. And of course, I said Kant refers to that looks like a lot, but it's nothing. It's really nothing. It looks like a lot, but it's really nothing. How he said, just about everything looks like a lot, but it's really nothing. No thingness, that kind of nothing. So that's what he's doing, and we're encouraged to practice manifesting. Let me just check something here. Yeah, okay. And so in the art practice, we're getting in touch with that energy. The Bodhisattva Manjushri, who uses the sword of understanding to cut through all the bonds of suffering. And when we suffer a lot, it's because we don't use that sword of understanding to understand. So it's there, the prajna is there. We have to use that sword right away to understand, to cut. And I've been working with the healing mantra of Manjushri. Omara paka kada nadi, omara paka kada nadi, omara para kak paka nadi, omara kara paka nadi, omara kara paka nadi. And though these are like the Shosai Myo, they're individual seed syllables. And they also do, though, have connection to symbolic meaning. So, and connection to spiritual qualities. So some people have found the Shosai Myo. A Dharani is a seed syllable. It's a healing chant. So when we vibrate with it, it sends the healing both in and out and through in all directions. And this is similar. But Kant's, who gave us, it looks like something, but it's really nothing. He has this schema laid out from the large sutra of perfect wisdom that I found. Om, om, ara, paka, nadi. Om is everything. Om, om. Ah leads to the insight that the essence of all things is unproduced. Om, ah, ra leads to the insight that all things are pure and free of defilements. Pa leads to the insight that all dharmas have been expounded in the ultimate sense. Right? Nothing's hidden in the dharma. All dharmas are available. They're all expounded constantly. Ka leads to the insight that arising and ceasing of things cannot be apprehended because in reality there is no arising or ceasing. Na leads to the insight that although the names for things change, the nature of things behind their names cannot be gained or lost. And D, sometimes you can just chant D, 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 is reflection, meditation, devotion, prayer, understanding, intelligence, wisdom. So sometimes you can just chant that and knowing what it's about, you just infuse that into your being. So that's why that liturgy can be so powerful. Amara Pada Rakinati, right? Just to say that. So what is Thich Nhat Hanh pointing for us? We aspire to learn your way, which is to be still and look deeply into the heart of things and into the hearts of people. We will look with all our attention and open-heartedness. We will look with unprejudiced eyes. We will look without judging or reacting. We will look deeply so that we will be able to see and understand the roots of suffering, the impermanent and selfless nature of all that is. We will practice your way, Manjushri, of using the sword of understanding to cut through the bonds of suffering, thus freeing ourselves and other species. With no hindrance in the mind, no hindrance, therefore no fear. Far beyond deluded thoughts, this is freedom. So many of us have been speaking how within the pandemic, there's been a slowing down. Things have slowed down. That external busyness slowed down. And actually, the characters in Chinese for busyness are translated as heart killing. And how now we're more faced with our mind. I hear people at home saying, oh my God, I'm just like my mind, because there's not these distractions that we would often do. It's just isolation, quarantine. So the mind and its movements and its kleshas are all, and its joys and all that are all very apparent. And people are recognizing, not just out, but here, this very prevalent, perhaps anxiety, restlessness that we carry. Noticing how the mind still runs very fast, like we're pursued by a ghost, right? Right behind us, just restless. Anxious, like something's after us. Drinking tea, do you notice? Talking to someone, the restlessness. Like each morning here at the monastery, we do a silent meal called Orioki. And where we might get a good view into how the mind is running. So we're all sitting in silence, no one's talking. Is there still running going on in the mind? Now I'm speaking from personal experience. We're just eating, but where is the mind? Are we thinking of here and there and everywhere? People, what's so-and-so doing? 10,000 miles from the reality in front of us. And then to practice, as he said, to see this and then look with our discriminating attention. Do we want to keep the whole thing going? That's what we can do. As soon as we come back to our meal, Manjushri arrives. We decided back. That energy. He says, Thich Nhat Hanh, in order to see deeply, to understand, to see deeply, to understand deeply, we have to stop. We have to stop. So that when we sit in front of our daughter, our friend, our partner, anything, thinking of the events of the day, and we feel the impatience and the restlessness for the next new. We know that our friend or our child or whoever's in front of us fades right out of our eyes in a way. Just fades out a little bit as we're filled. So we don't fully meet. And we feel that's suffering right there. And we might miss their suffering or what they're trying to tell us or just being with them. So we're missing what's offered and we miss what we are experiencing in that exchange. So we need to stop. We need to learn to stop. Because without stopping, we don't really know how to respond completely. I don't feel like I could feel that in myself. So when we come to practice, we know we sit down, calm down. That's the first step. Sit down so you can calm down, shamatha, right? Shamatha. And then we can look deeply. Once we start to sit down, calm down, slow down, then we can look deeply and get the insight into what's happening with us. That's vipassana, the insight. Oh, I see what a thought is. Oh, look how preoccupied I am. Oh, I was just lost for 10 minutes. Oh, we get the insight. That's Manjushri energy, the one who practices the insight, the vipassana meditation, looking deeply. They know how to look deeply. They know how to stop. They know how to stop in order to see deep into the heart of things, into the heart of living beings all around. And the heart I'm speaking of is states of mind, into the heart of things, into the states of mind that are occurring of ourselves and of others. That's the object of our observation. So then we bring that to when we sit, when we walk, when we stand, when we eat, when we play frisbee, when we pet Rudy. And this mind has been running life after life after life. And we wonder why we're anxious. So, what's dividing our undivided life? What's dividing our undivided life? This is what we can see and work with and see the karma within that. What divides our undivided life? So when we are walking, to do so in such a way to learn to stop the dialogue, release our mind, have the capacity to just do what we're doing and look deeply into what occurred. When we pay respect to the qualities of great wisdom and understanding, we are paying respect to Manjushri. And at the same time, we're paying homage to those qualities within ourself. So we can say, I will train myself to look at everything with all my sincerity, with wholeheartedness. I will learn to look with eyes without prejudice. Look with all our attention and open-heartedness. And this sword is not aggressive. You know, when I have one in my room, both a statue and as soon as I walk in, it's in a tanka. And there's a lot of space around this sword. So it's not, you know, the body language of stay away. You know how we put our, you can watch that in some political talks, building walls. They talk like this, don't come over this place right here. You know, it's not that kind of sword. It's much more available to whatever arrives. It's very open in that posture. Very fresh, meeting experiences, very fresh. If you read the piece I gave you by Daniel Layton in his book on Bodhisattva archetypes, he has this line where he says, kids say the darndest things. You know, he's speaking of this freshness, how kids have this very refreshing clarity, right? This ability to express insight about what's familiar, to see it so fresh that they astonish us in our interpretations, because we're these kind of stodgy adults, you know, with our perceptions that we've carried forever, and they're just like meeting things so fresh, and they kind of like cut through our stuffiness, you know. And in there, he tells the story of the emperor's new clothes, which he says is a story about human vanity, fear of truth, wisdom, stupidity, naivety, and incompetence, and the never-ending desire for power, material things, and a good position in society. That's the emperor. And of course, in the end, the emperor decides, you know, has all this money to get this fabric, to make this incredible outfit, right, that he wants. And all these people are employed to do this for this king. And at the end, and I know this is not like blowing a movie, you all know the story, so I'm going to the end. So at the end, he took all his clothes off, right, and they dressed him in the invisible clothes, and he brought all these people to accompany him. And so the con men there show him the clothes, the cape, the pants, I got a little ahead, and the coat, but actually there was nothing in their hands. They were empty-handed, right? And so everyone was afraid to come off as being stupid, so everyone kind of went along with it, and you know, they admired the fabric that wasn't there, and then advised the emperor to put the clothes on, put the nothing on himself. But he didn't know that, right? So the emperor takes off all his clothes, and they dress him in the invisible clothes, and they start this big procession. And his servants are walking behind him, like carrying the cape, and they have it raised, and everyone's admiring him. Wow, look at the new clothes. Until this one little boy sees the naked truth and yells out, "The emperor has no clothes on." Right? So that's Manjushri. just right to the core. There are no clothes. Stop playing. Stop playing around with the toys. Right? The kid does it. And I know when I shaved my head, the kids were the same way. Like, not afraid to stare. Like, they saw me, and they were not afraid to stare. And the parents would be like, "Stop, stop." And then you would hear, like, this very direct, "How come you have no hair?" And the parents would like, "Shh," you know. And I would answer them, you know, like, "Thank you for noticing. Yeah. Did you ever hear, you know, I tell, would you like to touch it?" At that time. And this little finger, you know, would be like, and the parents are horrified, you know, the stranger with no hair. And then the little finger would go, and I would do this with my head, like it was a big production, you know. But, I was also thinking of a time where I had a pediatrician I loved when I was young, Dr. Wiederman. He had the face of a rock, like pebbly, his face. And I remember he was always close to me, and his face was like a big boulder. I used to just be fascinated with his pox. He had pock marks, right? And he was so gentle, little hunchback, big black-rimmed glasses. And in his office, he had a sign that said, "Let them yell." And this woman had a child that was carrying on, and you know, it was embarrassing her after a while. The kid was just yelling and doing kid stuff, running around. And finally, she grabbed the kid and said by the collar and said, "Jesus Christ, will you sit down?" And my mother said, I went over and said, "Jesus Christ, would you like to play with me?" So, I hope that doesn't go away. So this is Manjushri's wisdom is not an acquired wisdom based on long years of intelligence or study. It's inherent. Inherent. Always available. Very, very fresh. So we need this. We need that to cut through to the delusion that's arising. We need to meet it that fresh and that curious, right? Ah, there you are. Right? Each time we are able to recognize something about how our attention is arranged and choose to open it if it's closed, choose to open it further if it's already open or seems open, we're practicing the wisdom of Manjushri. And that's why we need to calm down, to stop, to see. Like those times when we're experiencing this sinking feeling. You all know that sinking feeling, or a wandering mind. And then we have this insight that we can cut through these by coming back to the touchstone of the breath in the diaphragm, in the hara. Right there, that insight, that open attention to the whole bodily sensation, seeing, hearing, choosing to release thoughts by simply not completing the sentence, not the narrative. We are choosing wisdom over entertainment. Using the forms that we've learned in practice to cut through the sinking mind. Here's another example of Manjushri I was thinking of. Like, I'm sure we've all had that feeling where we're standing in a high place, like the top of a building or the edge of a rock, a balcony, a bridge, and you're looking down and you feel that possibility of falling and what that feels like, right? That zing. It's like you feel the power of like going into that, and a mysterious power of what can happen. So we back away from the edge. Maybe we grip something, a rock, a little tighter in response to that. Whoa, whoa, hold the railing. If the reaction is this strong just to looking down, we might actually experience a sensation like we're falling. And if this, of course, is not what's happening, but the sensation is there. And it can also happen, I realized, when we look up. Do you ever fall up? Like you're looking at a cloud and all of a sudden you feel like you have vertigo? Like you can go the other way as well. You fall up. So it's not just down. It's a very strange sensation, very distinct. But if we feel our feet on the ground, come back to the touchstone of the breath and the sensations of body and mind, we can clarify the condition. We can know that we're not falling, that everything is all right. This is the wisdom sword of Manjushri, cutting through delusion by opening to the details of present experience to give the sensation context. The sharp edge of the sword of Manjushri that cuts through confusion doesn't cut one thing away from the other. It's not cutting this to get away from that, cutting this to go towards that. So that's the double edge. It is finely detailed nuance as it moves through in and through the knowns, right? Back and forth. In any moment, we notice how our attention is arranged into states and stances and storylines, echoing back to ourselves what we already know as thoughts and feelings, and then to choose to open around them by opening attention in all directions, practicing the wisdom of Manjushri. No thought or feeling can be what we are or what the world is. We can cut through obsessive and deluded views by allowing ourselves to see clearly, to hear, to smell, to taste, to touch, to feel the world as it actually is. So in a text called the 700 Line Sutra, which is attributed to Manjushri, it begins with Manjushri waking up one morning and deciding he wanted to go sit in front of the Buddha just to be in the presence of the Buddha. And so he went and he sat outside the Buddha's hermitage contemplating the Buddha. And so other monks saw him and thought, oh, well, that's a pious and good thing to do. So they all sort of grouped there. They all went. So the Buddha felt all these people outside his door, and he sort of peeked out and said, what the hell? This is my version. What the hell are you doing? What are you all doing here in front of my hut? So they said, we've come to contemplate Buddha. And he said, well, who actually started this? Who had the first idea for it? And everyone was like, Manjushri. And he said, oh, well, that's all right then. And then he asked Manjushri what he was doing in order to point out to the rest of the Sangha the way to meet the teacher. And that consisted of Manjushri saying, contemplating the presence of the Buddha isn't contemplating the Buddha's body, isn't contemplating the Buddha's face, or his fingers and his toes, or his deeds, or anything of that nature, but simply what the Buddha is. And that, the Buddha's body and form and so on, is simply the presencing of those teachings. So then if one looks at, if one understands the Dharma, then one meets the Buddha in that moment. If one meets the Buddha, one understands, one meets the Dharma. Meeting the Buddha is being in the presence of Dharma. That's meeting the Buddha. Manjushri's wisdom cuts through the distortion of anyone creating imaginary concepts about something or someone, a separate I, a me, a mine, a self, an other. That's what's happening. Whenever we attempt to turn the process of realized practice, of what we find to be true about who and what we are, and try to make it into a position, a stance, you'll feel Manjushri breathing down your neck with that sword hovering over your head, ready to say, cut it out. Cut it out. Let yourself live. Let me live. Don't narrow and compress the world. And it could seem as though we don't have time to meet the moment as it is, rushing past everything. But that's why we have mindfulness, hearing Dharma talks, sitting down with ourselves in Zazen, interactions with the teachers, with the Sangha, as mirrors, and show us how to stop rushing past our experience. Somebody this week sent me a poem called Samurai Song. You know, the universe provides. I'll just read it because it's by Robert Pinsky, and I thought, oh my God, this is Manjushri. He writes, Samurai Song. When I had no roof, I made audacity my roof. When I had no supper, my eyes dined. When I had no eyes, I listened. When I had no ears, I thought. When I had no thought, I waited. When I had no father, I made care my father. When I had no mother, I embraced order. When I found no friend, I made quiet my friend. When I had no enemy, I opposed my body. When I had no temple, I made my voice my temple. I have no priest, my tongue is my choir. When I have no means, fortune is my means. When I have nothing, death will be my fortune. Need is my tactic, detachment is my strategy. When I had no lover, I courted my sleep. Also, Manjushri is known by the name of melodious voice, or what that was, melodious voice, or gentle one, noble youthful one, sweet sounding melodious voice, because Manjushri is known as a master of words and turning words, which made itself into the Zen tradition. The turning words. But I like that. It has to do with what's delivered by speech. The Bodhisattva practices wisdom by paying attention openly and unfolding this further and further. And this, of course, requires looking deeply into recognizing just what this means about what we call the self, where do we find the self, without taking a stance. Leighton writes, Einstein's oft-quoted remark that the first use at Hiroshima of the atomic bomb that he helped create was that everything had changed except our way of thinking. It is precisely the changing of beings' ways of thinking that might be the essence of Manjushri, Bodhisattva's work. Cutting through attachments to reified modes of thought about our lives and the world. In D.T. Suzuki's famous book on Zen, his one of his first ones, there's a part I was reading where someone meets him and asks, "After you're enlightened, do you suffer anymore? After you're enlightened, do you suffer anymore?" And D.T. Suzuki says, "Oh, yes. Yes, I do. You do." And the person said, "Well, have you suffered?" And little Dharma combat going on. And D.T. Suzuki said, "Yes. Yes. When my wife died, I cried bitter, bitter tears." And the person replied, "Well then, what's the point of practice?" And D.T. Suzuki said, Oh, my tears had no roots. My tears had no roots. So I was thinking about my own tears. If we think now about our tears, do we cling to some root, some source, some truth about our tears? Or are they just tears? Are they just tears? It's just rain. Not making it something other than it is. It's just tears. My tears have no roots. They're not about my stories. They're not about blame. They're just my tears. They're my complete freedom. So, with all that is in front of us, right now, all that is in front of us, only right now, to be still and look deeply into the heart of things, into the hearts of people. We'll be moved to react, but can we use our sword, the sword of understanding, to understand and to stop, to cut, to strengthen our vessel, conjure the image of riding on a stately lion who's calm, fearless, proud, with integrity. Look deep, so deeply that we will be able to see and understand the roots of suffering, the impermanent and the selfless nature of all that is. We will practice your way of using the sword of understanding to cut through the bonds of suffering, thus freeing ourselves and other species. Freedom to cry, freedom to laugh in the very next moment, freedom to hear the sounds around without judgment. That's Manjushri coming through. Yep.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the Monastery Store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.